Time to take a look at the wonderful world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Hi, everybody. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. If you have a question about an insect, I hope you'll join us. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. If you found something unusual or something you're trying to figure out how to get rid of or just have a curiosity about an insect, I hope you'll join in. And Phil, just to start, welcome, by the way. Thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Nice to be here.
We have sort of an issue with cutworms this winter. And this is something very unusual, if I'm not mistaken.
It's an ongoing story. Back about 10 years ago, my friend Les Fergie had caught a moth up in the Apostle Islands that was identified as Noctua pronuba. And we were excited because it was a state record. And it's also called the larger yellow underwing because it has this very characteristic bright yellow hindwing on it. Well, the larvae of that critter are called winter cutworms. And about 2 or 3 years ago, I started getting samples when we'd get a nice semi-warm day in December or January of people finding worms crawling out on their sidewalk. Well, they're winter cutworms. That's how this insect overwinters. That makes sense. But the mystery this year is during December, I received at least 8 samples from around the state of people finding these things crawling in their kitchen, their living room. And what I'm perplexed at is considering how cold it's been and how much snow it is, there's no way they were moving from there. So, you know, you can come up with theories of firewood, maybe spending time on a Christmas tree coming in. But I'll be honest with you, I have no good explanation of why all of a sudden. Now, this past summer, we did see a lot of adult moths in our light traps. So I'm just kind of wondering where this is all going. And again, I'm professionally stumped to come up with a good explanation.
Well, maybe we'll hear some more about those cutworms today on the show. I tell you what, Diana in Round Lake, Illinois is up first for us. So let's go there. Diana, hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, both me and my boyfriend have issues with the Asian, I think it's called an Asian bee. It looks like a ladybug.
Mm-hmm.
And come springtime, I know last year he had a brand new home. In one day, he had about 200 of them around his front window. I was wondering, is there a natural way that we can kind of deter them away from the home?
Well, the first thing is that everything you see in the spring really came in the fall. And what I'm suspicious of is there's some seam or opening that they got up underneath the siding and spent the winter there. And then in the spring, the ones that wake up are congregating and getting ready to leave. And so the big thing is, you know, it sounds like the house is sealed well enough. If it wasn't, you would have been experiencing Asian lady beetles from November all the way through the winter. And that's quite common. So the good news is things are tight enough. And with that in mind, I mean, you really don't have to do anything other than the bother. I mean, we do have people that are allergic to them and the like, but as long as they stay outside, they really shouldn't be an issue. But I would really look closely to see how that window frame is constructed to see if you can caulk or seal it, because they have to be squeezing out of some kind of opening.
Right. Somebody once told me that you could put cedar down, like cedar mulch, and that might keep them away. Have you ever heard of such a thing?
No. Well, cedar has some natural oils that have some insect repellency, and that's why the people use them in cedar closets and the like. But to be honest, wood chips and whatnot, that's going to have no effect. You know, people have talked about putting bay leaves in their house and that make them go again. There's no science behind that to show that it works. We found that, to be honest, the mosquito repellent DEET, the USDA was doing some testing, and they found that it had some repellency, which was quite surprising because we understand how it keeps mosquitoes away, but it really should have no business keeping Asian lady beetles away. But it has not been registered for that use. And to be honest, they were playing around with ways of impregnating it in parafilm or other things to extend the life. Because when you spray something on the outside of the house, it has to last for weeks, if not months. And that's one of the problems. The product does break down. So,
mm-hmm. All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Phyllis in Crivets. We're on to you now. Hi, Phyllis.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
We've had some difficulty that we have never had before, and that's with a very small, except in the summertime, I qualify that. In the summertime, we do see these little fruit flies that come in with the tomatoes, the fruit that you have in a bowl, but never in the wintertime. And this winter, we're having an increased problem with very small flies that are in the kitchen area. And I currently have covered up the fruit bowl, anything that's exposed, anything sweet, that might attract them, and they still hover around. And those little things are so fast, you can't kill them with a swatter. They're gone before you can get your hand down to them.
Okay. Well, I have two concerns. One is there are a number of little gnats that you do get in the house, and depending who it is would point us in a different direction. Most of the fruit flies that we get indoors, if you look at them close, they have either reddish or almost maroon-like eyes. So anybody, times people tell me, well, they're little gnats, but they seem to have reddish eyes, I know they're fruit flies. If they seem to behave, as you had mentioned, being attracted to smelling, you know, fruity-type things or sugars, or if you have a glass of wine, if they dive bomb that, that's very characteristic of fruit flies. If, on the other hand, there isn't that pattern, I worry about fungus gnats and drain flies and forage flies. So one of the things I'll offer is I'm more than happy to take a look if you want to send some down, but as far as fruit flies in the house in the winter, the only explanation, because they have a short life cycle, is they are breeding continuously. What they need to breed is organic matter that is decaying. In fact, what it is, it's the yeast associated with the decay process that the fruit fly maggots feed on. In order for the organic matter to decay, you need moisture. So it's a combination of basically the food and some moisture. And, you know, I have found them in rotting garden bulbs that people brought in, bad onions, bad potatoes. Recycling cans, if you've got some that are off somewhere you're not thinking about, just even the kind of sugary syrup we get in a lot of cans is enough to have them breed. But it's a point source problem. And even if you could catch the adults, if you can't find the food source, you will have this continuous flow of fruit flies. So it may take some investigating. It's not something I suggest spraying for, because all that does is kill the adults in the environment, and you really need to kind of hunt down that source. So again, think about things you might have brought in that have some moisture to them. And the other thing, we call them vinegar flies at times differentiate from the fruit flies that we get on our apples outside and the like. And that's the kind of thing I think about. When things get overly ripe, they have this vinegary or acetic acid smell, and that's exactly the kind of things that attract fruit flies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you are describing very, just almost to the letter, the fruit fly, as far as what these are interested in. My one question then, after your comments, is it possible, I do have a compost pail in the utility room here, just off the kitchen, and which I try to keep the composting all winter long to do that. And I'm just wondering, could that be a source?
That would be a classic. And what will be the giveaway is usually the maggots are relatively small, but when they transform to the adult flies, they often crawl up out of the compost, and you see this little yellowish to brownish capsules, which are the pupal cases.
Oh.
And those would be a dead giveaway. So, yeah, I mean, that's just a classic food source for them. And if they have gotten access to it, you know, they turn a life cycle in about 2 weeks normally indoors. So it doesn't take them very long. And they have this, and it makes sense because you have this continuous food source that keeps getting refreshed, and that makes them happy as heck.
Yeah. So if you take that pail and put it outside overnight.
Yeah, you could freeze them out very easily. They won't tolerate, especially living in a warm environment like that. The shock alone is enough to kill them.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest. And Phil, we had an email from Lisa, and you have a picture in front of you. I have attached a picture, she says, of a big bug we found in our office. Could you please tell me what it is? This is from the Menominee Indian Reservation in northeast Wisconsin. Happy ending. The big bug got released back into the wild.
The critter has two common names. We often call it the giant water bug. It is sometimes also called the electric light bug, and it is impressive. You can get specimens that are upwards of about 2.5 to 3 inches long. They are predators in ponds and lakes on fish and other insects. And often in the fall of the year, they migrate from small bodies of water that might freeze out to larger bodies of water. So it's quite common for people to see them in being attracted to lights, you know, security lighting is they're drawn to the house. Neat critters, again, one of the biggest insects we see in the state. The only caution I give people is you got to be a little careful to handle them. They have this very distinctive beak, and they can give a very impressive bite if you're foolish enough to get your finger in front of that beak. But, I mean, they're not, by nature, they're not aggressive. But, again, if you're handling them, you got to be careful and respect the potential bite.
They'd probably be the biggest insect we would have see in Wisconsin, or one of the largest.
Yeah, one of the largest. I mean, we got some other water beetles that are maybe a little more bulky than these guys. They have very... very pronounced front forelegs, and that's what they use to grasp their prey and bring it in. So that's kind of characteristic. Very beady eyes, almost like a frog. So if you've never seen one, they're kind of hard to describe, but once you've seen them, you don't forget them. You know, again, what confuses people, you often see them out of water. If you were out looking for, you know, catching helger mice for fishing and whatnot, these would show up in the net.
And they're called again?
Giant water bugs is the official common name. But because of this attractancy, some people call them electric light bugs.
Would you have them on your website?
I do. I have a section under the ID section that's just called Big Bugs, and this one is pictured because I do see quite a few samples come in or get calls on them.
And then how do people get to that website?
I'm in the entomology department, so it's entomology.wisc for Wisconsin, .edu. That will take you to the department website, and you can go under Outreach in the Diagnostic Lab and go under Bug ID, or if you want to get to it a little quicker, after the EDU, it is a / ENTODIAG, which stands for the Diagnostic Lab.
Okay.
And that will get you, and just go under the ID section, Big Bugs, and it will pop up.
All right. Let's go to Lisa in Hillsboro. Lisa, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I've never had such a problem as this winter with box elder bugs. I mean, just terrible. I didn't know if there's something to discourage them or...
Okay. Well,
why they're attracted this year versus other years.
It's a little curious this year because overall statewide, I think their numbers are down considerably, and it has to do with moisture levels. Box elder bugs do very well when we have dry late summers, and their nature is to look for shelter. And so in the fall of the year in September, you often see these large clusters on the outside of the house, and they're trying to sneak under the siding or the wood pile or any shelter they can find. And it was wet enough this fall. What the moisture does is promote a natural fungus disease, which is probably the biggest control factor for them. And so, as they said, the weather patterns have not been conducive to have large numbers statewide, especially with the heavy rains that we had so often. But I will say, I mean, now you're still basically paying for what snuck in the fall. It really isn't worth doing much for spraying. Again, much like we had talked earlier with the Asian lady beetles, the two options in the fall of the year, either you tighten up the thing so they can't squeeze through it, or there are sprays that can be applied, but it would be appropriate to do it in September, not now.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. The Asian lady beetles, we have, I think this winter, we've had probably, if I think back over the entire winter so far, say maybe 8. So not too many in our house.
Well, you know,
one pops up every so often.
Overall, the last 2 or 3 years, the numbers seem to be dramatically down. Now, that's still relative because I was out in October one day and I was next to a machine shed and it was orange. There were so many, you know, one of those typical 60-degree sunny days, and they just exploded and whatnot. So it's not that they've totally disappeared, but if we look back in the later 1990s when they really would just absolutely go crazy statewide, I've seen this relative lowering of populations, which is pretty typical of invasive insects. You know, it seems when they first get established, they cause the biggest problem. You know, my experience has been the same with earwigs. I'm even seeing that, believe it or not, with Japanese beetle in Madison, in the central part of the city, we're seeing numbers down. But on the out edges where they're still starting, the numbers are going crazy. So it is relative. And even with the Asian lady beetle, you know, I tell people, if you had 100,000 in your farmhouse, you know, 5 years ago, and now you only have 20,000, you're still not happy. So it's relative. But I do agree, the numbers have been dramatically down.
Well, one here or there, you know, for our cat tiger, it gives him lots of pleasure chasing him around. Let's go to Caitlin and Ephraim next. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. We have about a 70-year-old wooden guest cottage that's just off of the water in sort of a cedar wooded area. And for the last 3 years, when our friends and family members stay there, they wake up in the morning with these tiny red little bumps all over them. And I think there's like a little white dot in the center of that. And it itches like crazy. And the doctors haven't been able to figure out what it is. We've fumigated, we've called exterminators, and no, we can't see the bug. And we really don't know how to find it. And we've vacuumed and soaped and watered the mm-hmm. whole place and redid the roof and the mattress. And we're kind of at a lost, we just don't know where to go from here, I guess.
So you're telling me it seems seasonal.
It's definitely seasonal. Usually in the month of July is when it really okay. gets bad.
Have you ever had problems with bats in the structure?
Not that I've noticed,
okay.
no.
Well, that will rule out. There is a bed bug associated with bats that will give us some problem. The mm-hmm. second thought, because of the timing of the year, is bird mites. And what mm-hmm. makes bird mites problematic is they're not breeding or living in the structure itself. Mm-hmm. They're usually associated with bird nests outside. And okay. so it often when the birds fledge, that's when the mites have nothing to eat and they start migrating in. The bites you describe are very characteristic of bird mites, the kind of blistery-like effect. But the mm-hmm. problem is you go in and bomb and treat and you kill what's there, but you're really not getting after the problem. And so what I would suggest is to be observant of if there's any birds nesting in the overhangs or whatnot, is discourage that. If there's no birds to start with. The other thing I think to help you verify this, you can buy these little, we call them glue boards, but these little sticky cardboard traps. Mm-hmm. They use bigger versions for mice. You can buy those, but there are smaller versions that are used for insect monitoring. And place those in windowsill or underneath the bed. My experience, when bird mites are around, they will crawl in and they're big enough to see. I describe them as walking pepper grains. I mean, you can see them against a white background. You can see about the size of a normal pepper grain, and they're moving around. And so that would be my guess. There's so much that fits that you're telling me that's going on that I really bet you that's what it is.
Okay, well, I really appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phil Pelletieri, our guest as we talk insects. And Phil, I have an email from Robin who says, every summer we have the most interesting little bugs flying around our farm in the Kickapoo Valley. Small, a little bigger than a fruit fly, light blue in color, body looks like it has a feathery fuzz, clear wings, but appear to float in the air more than fly. They're also completely disintegrate if you touch them. We have no idea what they are. What do you think?
Well, undoubtedly it's a woolly aphid, and if I had to guess, it's probably a woolly alder aphid. Aphids, of course, are pretty small-bodied, and these things excrete like a waxy filament, and it's very impressive. The filaments can be 4 or 5 times longer than the critter. And it's almost like cotton candy. So they're like little fuzz balls flying through the air, which catches people's attention. It's interesting. They jump back and forth between alder and maple. Those are the two plants that they breed on. And on maple, occasionally, about once every 5 or 6 years, they get to be so numerous that we have some minor problems on the tree, yellowing, stickiness on the leaves, those kind of things. And so usually what people are seeing is when they're going back and forth between the different hosts. Oh. And pretty much harmless. And again, when you crush them, the filaments fall apart, and there isn't that much to the body. I mean, as you know, aphids are, you know, 1.5-2 millimeters in size, and just not a whole lot of mass to them. So I'm sure it's a woolly aphid and would lean to that particular species. There are numerous other ones, but that's the one that most often I see come in. You definitely have the right kind of plants in the Kickapoo Valley to support them. So.
Okay. Ben in Superior, on to you now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question. My apartment is sometimes, well, I guess it's kind of varies from season to season, but there's a lot of spiders. And it seems to me an abnormal amount of spiders.
Okay, are you close to a body of water?
A few blocks off of Lake Superior.
Okay, well, that'd probably be... The reason I ask is in general, you find incredible spider numbers close to lakes, and like just because there's so many insects that come off the water that are attracted to the security lights, and spiders have to feed on either other spiders or insects, and so they take advantage of the situation. So that's the first thing that we always look at. Is the other thing that you find is that houses that have vines and other shrubbery growing on it, again, just is the kind of environment that does better for spiders. Spiders are really pretty much harmless in this state. The recluse is not established here and rarely seen. the black widows. And interesting enough, I saw more black widow specimens this year than in the 30 years I've been in the lab.
Huh.
But still, we're only talking six. So,
okay.
And nobody's getting bit. They just are bumping into them. But so, you know, we look at kind of sealing things up. You know, when people have a lot of spiders, I often tell them to send them to me because one of the things we can sometimes determine, are they just outside spiders that are wandering in by accident? Or there are a handful of spiders that will breed indoors. Some of the sac spiders are examples, some of the jumping spiders. Probably the best defense for most spiders is the vacuum cleaner. You know, and we tell people, you know, what you do, because spiders like to hide in cracks and corners, is once every 2 or 3 months, get the special attachment out there and just go in all those seams and whatnot, and you will make a major impact by doing that. Some spiders are relatively long-lived, can live 2 or 3 years indoors, and so you could be seeing the same spider cruising back and forth, but you know, that combination of asking why is there a lot of food around for them and are they wandering in? So there are sometimes adjustments you can make to lessen the numbers. I don't expect them to get rid of them all, but maybe make them a little less problematic.
There you have it.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, Ben. Peg in Rice Lake, your turn. Hi, Peg.
Hi there. I have a solution for the Asian ladybug problem in the house.
All right.
Light fixtures. Put in old-fashioned incandescent bulbs in just one light, maybe, and get one of those clip-on light fixture covers.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, they commit suicide.
Well, you know, it definitely, in fact, they sell, you know, various light traps and electrocuting devices that use UV light, and that basically is the theory behind them. What I tell people about that, though, is that you've already let the problem move into the house, and then this is just a way of lessening the numbers. I like to take a step back and say, you know, you have to consider that all this started in the fall, and can you find out how they're squeezing in? You know, for some houses, you know, they only see them in the bathroom. Well, in that case, it's, you know, I would check the vent fan, the windowsill around the bathroom. In other cases, it, you know, they're just showing up everywhere. And in some houses, to be honest, there's just too many openings to ever seal them up. Although the more time you do it, there's a dear friend of mine who runs a pest control company up in north of Green Bay, Warner Pest Control. And he is the best person I know to physically seal things up.
Ah.
And so he was telling me, you know, they had a client who had a great big A-frame building, tremendous problems. And he and his crew spent 2 days with a caulking gun working on sealing this up.
Wow.
And made an incredible difference. And, you know, so it was a lot of time and effort initially, but they solved the problem by physically tightening things up. He's also very good at getting mice out of buildings for the same reason, as you have to understand the engineering and construction side of it. But if you have people like that are willing to spend the time and do it. So for some of these problems, I tell people, the carpenter, a good carpenter is your best source, not necessarily somebody that's going to come and spray something.
All right. Can I say one more thing?
Sure.
That light fixture solution was so, remember that bad year we had? Was that 3-4 years ago?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was so effective that every night I'd leave it on during the day, even into the evening. Now, we're supposed to save electricity, but frankly, I think the damage to the environment is much less than chemical sprays, probably. And I would replace my incandescent bulb with the fluorescent when the problem was done. But every night during that Asian ladybug onslaught, I would pull that cover off the light, and it would be full of ladybugs, and I would dump it. And then I'd put it back on.
And there you go.
And I had them. There were none here.
Well, you know, and I've seen people take the other way, where they'll take a sticky card underneath it so the lady beetles fall onto the card, mm-hmm. and they can just remove that part of it. But again, as you say, sometimes it gets so bad. I've seen a card the size of an 8 by 11 piece of paper absolutely coated with lady beetles in a night. And so then you know they have tremendous numbers. And again, that's the ones that I would say, you know, you got to get at this earlier and not allow them to get in the house, or, you know, they're a mess. And again, people are having significant allergy problems to these things. As we know, when we bother them, they bleed through their joints. It's called reflex bleeding, and they're leaving proteins behind that are very strong smelling, which that's why the birds and other predators often stay away from them. But that's also what's giving people the allergy problems.
Thanks, Peg, for calling. Appreciate it very much. Turning to Christy and Kokana next. Hi, Christy.
Hi. I just had a comment about the water beetle. My brother-in-law had picked one up walking across the parking lot, and it ended up at my house. Well, my children ended up putting it into a fish tank in the basement, and now it lives happy in there. It's probably about 2.5 inches, maybe 3 inches.
Mm-hmm.
And we just throw minnows in there, and he eats them, and the boys are really fascinated to see.
Ah, neat. Well, you did your homework to know what to feed it and the like, and you know, I remember a story when I was a student. The person that basically opened the world of entomology to me was Dr. Bob Dick, and he had a specimen in his collection that they had caught in the tropics when he was in the Army, and this thing was about 4.5 inches. Just the most impressive giant water bug I've ever seen, and he tells the story that he was in a boat, and they saw this thing swimming, and there was a young man with him that grabbed it, and the thing bit his hand. And he said in a matter of a minute, his hand was paralyzed to the point that they couldn't hardly pry the insect out of it, and swelled and whatnot, so extremely painful. It was nothing worse than that, but, you know, for a couple of days, he was in a lot of discomfort. So that's why I've always been impressed with them, and have caught quite a few, but have been lucky enough never to get nipped by them, but said they make great pets. They are relatively long-lived, and if the kids want to...
Yeah, we don't touch them at all, and I had never seen anything like it in my life, so once I looked it up and realized, you know, that they're actually, you know, here in Wisconsin, and, makes me not want to swim.
The other thing that's quite interesting, well, you know, another name I've heard for them is toe nippers, because people talk about when you're swimming, and there's the giant water bug, but there's a smaller species, Bellostoma, which is only about an inch long. Another interesting fact about that group of insects is the males carry the eggs. The females lay them on the males, and you can sometimes capture a male that's just absolutely covered with eggs, which is in the insect world kind of weird. Another piece of insect trivia, in Thailand and whatnot, people literally collect the eggs and eat them, like caviar.
Oh. Ew.
Yeah, I know.
Thanks, Christy.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye. Appreciate the call. Oh, man. Bobby and Altoona, on to you now. Hi, Bobby.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have always thought of myself as a party person, but I am absolutely sick and tired of having slugs come to the beer parties that I'm putting out under my hostas.
And boy, you want something else to get rid of those slugs.
I certainly do. Can I give them whiskey, or is there something else that I can do?
Well, unfortunately, on the beer side, you know, the people that have worked with it tell us that the best beer are the expensive Bock beers and whatnot that have. So it's not as even if you can give them light beer, because they don't care. the problem with beer is more just if it's raining and you get the kind of environmental conditions the slugs like, it honestly just washes your beer away. And it's tough because the environment hostas grow under is what is ideal for slugs. It's always moist. It's always shady. And there's plenty of organic matter to feed on. And they are fond of hostas. That's one of the top things they like to feed on. If you're a person that are inclined to, there are various baits that are on the market. An organic bait is iron phosphate.
Iron phosphate.
And it's sold as escargot. One of the names, but there's a slug getta and bug getta, which are not organic, but are also baits. They're little pelleted baits you put out. You sprinkle this on the soil, and when the slugs come in contact with it, it will kill them. Some people have played around with oyster shell scale or ground oyster shell, and, you know, it is abrasive. It does work in some environments, but that stuff tends to blow in the wind and whatnot, so it makes it a little bit more difficult. But, you know, you pray for drier weather. That will help. I have seen some of these slug baits sold in little plastic containers so that they're somewhat protected from the weather. They last a little bit longer that way. But unfortunately, this is one of those cases I tell people, if you make your backyard a sandbox, you want to have slugs. But, you know, if you like growing plants, we're doing things to help the plants out that also, you know, the mulch also is very good for slugs, but it's also good for plants. So,
But I don't have regular mulch down. I have rock, like decorator river rock things.
Mm-hmm. Well, that won't give them organic matter, but it gives them places to hide. That's a lot of what the shelter is about for slugs, is they can't get caught out in the sunlight in the day, they die. So the more places for them to hide under, the happier they are. I would assume, though, that you're probably on a little bit heavier soil.
Yes.
Yeah. You tend to see a lot of problems in clay. I know in our perennial gardens, we see a lot of them come crawling out from the stonework. You know, we have a bunch of stone walls, and they're hiding in there all during the day and come out cruising at night. And back a few years ago, I used to hand pick them and throw them into a bottle of tequila, but That was fun, and I got my revenge. But
would be out there from now until the time I'm 110.
Yeah. No, it is a situation that if you've got a very lush environment, they will always do quite well. The other thing, this year I got a giant leopard slug sent to me from the Milwaukee area. These are get up to 6 inches long.
Oh.
And I was surprised. I was not aware that we had the population in Milwaukee, and it has been there from Joan Joss from the Milwaukee Public Museum has been tracking this, and it told us that they've been there for a long time. So people out in the Northwest run into banana slugs and some of these other ones, but we've got a couple impressive slugs that occasionally show up too.
Thanks, Bobby, for calling. Appreciate it. And Jamie in Colfax, on to you. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, guys. How you doing this morning?
Good.
This is more like kind of a research question. If there's been research done on impact of electric lights and insect populations, if it has any. I mean, 100 years ago, when there weren't as many, outside lights and stuff, it made a difference on populations.
Well, the one that I'm aware of that was the electric lights was brought up as a potential cause for the elimination of wild silkworms in Central Park. The big moths like Cecropia and Promethea were just disappeared, and they were native to that area. And so people, again, New York, lights everywhere, that's goofing up the moths. And so that was one of the explanations. But as they dug into it deeper, it turned out there was an imported parasite that was brought in to control gypsy moth that also attacked the wild silkworms. And so that tended to be the thing that was responsible. So in general, even though we do kill a lot of insects, insects have this incredible reproductive potential, and they are prey to so many different things. And so in some sense, electric lights are just like a flock of birds as far as what they do to things. And so, no, I'm not aware of any particular species that have been documented to be in decline because of electric lights.
Hmm. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it, James. Peggy and Brilliant, on to you now. Hi, Peggy.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I heard the gentleman about the spider control thing, and I found a way to control them without my fiance going in the basement and letting off those awful chemical bombs.
Mm-hmm.
We had spiders in our basement. We moved in an older farmhouse. Once we cleaned the basement up and painted it, we still had them. But I found that once I started doing hobbies with eucalyptus or bringing in sprigets of arborvitas, like clippings off the ends of the trees where you get a lot of the foliage, they actually started disappearing. And the more I use cedar chips or cedar in the closets and more arborvita or more of the eucalyptus in the house, the less spiders I saw. And I now have it pretty well under control down even in the basement just by hanging those things up. You just have to refresh them like I do it in the spring and then again in the summer just to make sure that you have a good fall and winter coverage. But it seems like the more we use that kind of thing in the house, the less the spiders come in. They pretty much stay outside.
Well, it's interesting. There are some products you can buy now that are using eucalyptus oil as a contact insecticide. There's other products using clove oil. There's a real resurgence in interest in some of the natural products. And I know those sprays sprayed on the spider will kill them.
I'm just wondering, too, I need to ask you, not to interrupt, but do you have a life cycle of those insect wasps, those wonderful little guys that fly around in the summer and eat bugs? We have lots of them in my gardens. We have a quarter acre of walking gardens outside of Brilliant, and they just fly all over, like from about June on. And we notice every year we still have a really good supply of them. Are they going to last for a long time, or?
Well, there are multiple species of wasps that are predators. In fact, the paper wasps are very effective at caterpillars and other things. And we have a new one moving in the state now, the European paper wasp. And it's interesting, some of the places where it has been established, aside from the minor problems that if one starts a nest, in your mailbox, you've got to deal with that. But the other side of it is that caterpillars in general, the worms on your cabbage and whatnot, have really become few and far between because they are such efficient predators.
Yeah.
I don't expect those in any case. I mean, we're somewhat concerned when you bring these exotic European species in, they often... it's at the cost of our native species. So that's one biological question. But on the broader scale, they're just basically filling a niche that's already there. And as I said, these European ones seem to be extremely efficient at eating up caterpillars and larvae of some of the beetles, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm always telling people in the nursery, I work at a nursery in the summer, and I keep telling people, don't kill those, and they're like, oh, those are good? And I explained that, how they look, the black ones, the black-bodied with the kind of space in between the front and the bottom part of their bodies, and that they have wings. And people are like, oh, I thought those would hurt you. And I said, oh, no, they'll land on you and they won't hurt you. Yeah, they're looking for aphids. Unless you're covered with aphids, then they might hurt you.
I remember on this show a few years back, we got a call from a person who was observing the big bald-faced hornets picking off flies on the side of the barn.
Yeah.
You know, just coming
That's
in
right.
and grasping it and flying off with it. And as I said, so they do have a wide variety of prey that they feed their young, and that's definitely a very beneficial side. And my colleague Bob Jean had some students working with basically cabbage worm control by putting the nests in the garden and watching, and they did find significant positive effects.
Thanks for calling,
Peg. Thank you.
Appreciate that call. And Bill in Wausau, thank you for calling. Hi.
I want to congratulate you. You have a wonderful program.
Thank you.
Anyway, I was a kid wading in the marsh up here southeast of Wausau, maybe 10 years old. One of those, maybe like a quarter water bug stung me back the knee. I was numb from the armpit down.
Well,
and
yeah.
That sucker burned when it bit.
Well, if you think about it, if they feed on fish, and there have been documentations of these giant water bugs taking a 6-inch trout down, the saliva that they have has to paralyze their prey. And so, yeah, that's what I think about. Aside from just the physical side of the pain of the bite, if they inject enough of the saliva, you can expect to have localized reactions. I mean, it's not life-threatening, but as you say, numbing, and even in some cases, maybe a little bit of minor tissue damage would not be out of the ordinary because of the enzymes.
Well, I had a little white dealy form, like a big, huge whitehead after that, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Well, thanks for the call.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phil Pelletieri, our guest here on the Ideas Net as we talk insects with him. And Phil, I had an email about fleas and ticks. The person writes, can you talk about fleas and ticks when they're most prevalent? I use topical flea and tick repellent on my border collie, but lay off a bit when the temperature drops to the single digits, like now. How does cold weather affect these parasites? Are they active even when it's bitter cold?
Well, it depends on where the ticks I'm not worried about. Basically, the rule with ticks outdoors is if there's snow on the ground, there's no ticks. Fleas, though, what gets difficult is outdoors fleas are very seasonal, but most of the flea problems we have are fleas breeding indoors, you know, that your dog has run into them, picked them up from another dog, or we find that the cat flea, which is the most common one we see on dogs and cats, are also found on possums and raccoons. So in the city, a lot of times they're picking them up from these wild animal hosts, bringing them in, and then they'll breed continuously because the environment indoors is just like it is outdoors in the summer. So I would say if you've got no sign of flea problems and you're in the 1st of November, you can back off until we get well into probably May before you'd be concerned. And if it's an inside dog, it shouldn't get exposed to fleas. They're just as, you know, a flea is relatively long-lived, but fleas tend to be associated with the nest or the resting area of the animal. So they're very localized. And interesting enough, you know, I know down in Florida they breed outdoors and whatnot in people's lawns. We don't see that here. They'll breed in the dog kennel because the conditions are right, but not out in the lawn. The larval stage of the flea feeds on the dried blood associated with the adult feeding that accumulates in that nest. But the dried blood that would fall in a person's yard would be degraded and break down before any fleas have a chance to breed off it.
Deborah in Racine, your turn. Hi, Deborah.
Good morning.
Morning.
Last fall, I was looking out my kitchen window, and there was a praying mantis stand there. Are they resident populations? I didn't know we had them here.
Where are you located?
Racine.
Okay. The story with mantids is up until about 10 years ago or so, we always told people, you know, our winters are cold enough that the egg masses, that's how they survive, they're called oatheca, they look like a spongy golf ball, would freeze out and they wouldn't make it. But we've been convinced now in the last 5 years in particular that we do have breeding populations, probably in the southern two tiers of counties. And I equate that to the milder winters. And, you know, you probably heard me say before, the governor moved us to Missouri and didn't tell us. This is an example of one of those insects that was always more southern when I first started, but now we're seeing very concrete evidence of them moving northward, their range moving northward, and we think it's associated with the milder winters.
Hmm.
So, yes, yeah, it's resident.
He stayed long enough, I was able to take his picture.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting is that there's both a Chinese and a European manta. Neither of them are native, that are the most common ones we see here. In other parts of the U.S., there are some native mantas. They're smaller and whatnot. But the big ones, the big impressive ones we see, as I said, are not native. But they're not necessarily the best biological control agent because they don't feed on aphids and mites. But they're great critters to have around. And if you got kids, boy, they're just impressive for the kids to sit and just watch and observe.
Absolutely. Thanks, Deb.
He's about 5 inches.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Bill in Appleton, we're on to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call, guys.
Sure.
Say, I just had a comment, really, and maybe one little question. I respect the efforts of people trying to control the centipedes and spiders in their homes. My method of control is just to leave them alone. And I was wondering, what do they eat over the winter? Are they eating mealy bugs and little bugs that I can't see, or what?
Well, the first thing is their food demands are down because they're slowed down because of the coolness of the environment. So if they're in wall voids and whatnot, you notice you just don't see as much activity. But I had a centipede go across the kitchen floor a couple nights ago. He was out cruising looking for food, and he'll eat other centipedes. He'll eat spiders. He'll find sow bugs. We'll find, again, box elder bugs and Asian lady beetles. Those kind of fall invaders make great food for a lot of these. And the thing that we always try to get people to think of, much like you mentioned, is that they have to have an insect food source. So the more spiders you have, the more critters that are coming in. And if you can address that critter problem, you're really solving two problems at once, if that's what's going on.
Well, I guess I just don't see the spiders hanging out and the centipedes hanging out as a specific problem, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't. Thanks, Bill. Appreciate the call. And Larry in Menominee, we turn to you next. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I'll give my question and I'll hang up because I'm about to fade out here. How does one control the Colorado potato beetle other than with spray or with the use of different potato that's not edible by them?
Boy, the problem with them is they're a little too mobile. You know, for some insects, you say, well, you rotate your crops. You move them from here to there and they won't get it. But, you know, Colorados, if they're anywhere within a half a mile of you, I expect them to find your potatoes. The other problem that we've been having is that a lot of the chemicals that people were standardly using in the garden just don't work anymore. You know, the old standby, again, 20 years ago, was the insecticide 7. My take on it is they're all resistant in the state to that particular chemical. My colleague Jeff Wyman had done some interesting work, and there's still some ongoing in the department, where if you get Colorado potato beetles, they overwinter as adults in litter. And if you can get out there and rake the snow and litter and disturb them so that they're kind of exposed, they are wimps. They can't put up with temperatures much below 20 degrees. And so if you knew where they were, that would be one option, is to get them. Another interesting control method was developed and played with in New England, where they dug trenches around the crop. And when these things were migrating from the woodlots in, they would fall in the trenches. They put a little bit of plastic in there so he'd fall in and couldn't crawl out, and then they could just, you know, pour water or soapy water or whatnot. So if you know where they're coming from, you may be able to intercept them when they're migrating in late May, early June, because that's kind of when they wake up and start their thing. The one thing that I've been sharing with people that I think is an option now that works both for organic people and not, is there is a chemical spray. Spinosad is the name of it. And this is a natural product that is derived from a soil fungus. And this is sold under the name Entrust, and Gardens Alive sells it under the name Bullseye. And so it's becoming readily available, and the Colorados are not resistant to it. So if you are inclined to use chemicals, what I would tell you is when the adults are laying eggs and they're just starting to hatch, that's when you want to shut the door. It's going to be in the middle of June in most of the state. And then if you spray with one of these products, you will have much better results. Where people make the mistake is they let them get going, and then what you find is that they've got life stages that are out there you cannot control by spraying. The adults aren't controlled by the sprays very well, and the eggs are definitely not controlled. So in the spring, when the first wave comes, everything's on the same timeline. Later in the summer, it gets strung out.
And thanks for calling, Larry. Appreciate it. Tom in Mequon, on to you now. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I live near some woods and some farms, so I've got both deer flies and horse flies, and I'd heard earlier in the show someone was talking about wasps and hornets that'll take flies. I'm wondering, will they take that kind of flies? And if they do, could I find some of those wasps and maybe bring them to where I live?
Yeah, boy, they're too fast, is my take on it. I know Dr. McCabe, who's at the Wildlife Ecology Department, was working with some fly catchers, and I helped him out with one of these, and it was amazing how many deer flies and whatnot they were chasing down. But these are active birds that have a chance at least of keeping up with them. You know, deer flies and the like breed in swamps and wet areas, but then the adults can fly good distances away, so it's not like you've got control of the breeding site. There are some traps out there that help a little bit. There's that horse pal trap that's sold up in out of Amro, which is basically a trap that attracts them, and then they fly up and get caught in a container. I've got a great picture in a gentleman in the Cottage Grove area was telling me he'd go walk his dog, was having a terrible time. They're flying around his head. And I had told him about these sticky cards that are sold in the sporting goods stores. They're double-sided tape you put on the back of your baseball cap, and then when the flies land on it. Well, he took it one step further. He took a large black pot covered with tanglefoot, a very tacky material, and when he'd go walking his dog, all the flies would get caught on it. And he shared a picture with me, and so we've got about this 6-inch pot that is absolutely covered with deer flies. So he was happy. It does not control them in the long run, but at least it gave him the relief he was looking for. But the bottom line is, again, they do have their natural enemies, but I don't know of any fly or any insect enemies that are that good. Robber flies, maybe, but those are impossible to promote. And I've never seen them have enough of an impact to reduce the population. So, as I said, if they're really problematic, you may want to look into some of these commercial traps that are available.
Where do you think I can find them?
Well, on the internet. I said, if you do a horse pal trap, looks like a big black beach ball that's hung on a tripod. In fact, you can go to my website, too. I've got the design under my horse fly information sheet. So if you just go to the diagnostic lab, go to extension bulletins, and go under horse and deer fly, there'll be a sheet explaining the life cycle and whatnot. And then on the back of it, it's really a USDA design. And so you can make it yourself. You just, again, have to have this. The beach ball is the attracting object. And then on the top of the tripod, they usually will coat it with plastic. And what happens is when the flies fly in and see it's nothing to eat, they fly upwards and get caught in the cone up on top. And so it doesn't use chemicals. And then once they get caught in the top, you know, they die in sunlight. They desiccate quite quickly. Now, you have to put this trap out in the open. You don't want to put it in the middle of the woods because, these flies are attracted to movement. That would be an option if you're a bit handy with wood and whatnot. It doesn't take much to make one.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Tom, for calling. Michael in Seneca, on to you now. Hi, Michael.
Yeah, hi. I'm actually buying a new home, and there is just dead flies around every window and the doors of this new home. That must have came at some other point in the year. They're all just dead laying on the ground now. I'm just wondering what that means and if I should be concerned or how do they even get there?
Sure.
That's kind of my question.
Well, what we would often refer to as a winter fly. It looks like a house fly, but it's not. It's something we call a cluster fly. Much like the box elder bugs and a couple of these other critters, their claim to fame is migrating into structures in the fall. And so if this house was open, where the windows were you putting in and whatnot, it's thousands of them can get in. Generally, in new construction, things are tight enough that they're not a problem. When they aren't tight enough, if the soffits aren't designed properly or whatnot, there are some adjustments you can make. But the bottom line is all the dead flies came in basically in September. And so that's either when you want to stop them, but I can guarantee you they're not breeding. And often what happens is the ones that do get inside do exactly what they did for you. They die. It's not a good environment. It's too warm in the house. They should be cold and dormant. They're not dormant. They basically burn their energy reserves. So
it's not a real big thing to worry about.
No.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. And Brian in Lake Villa, Illinois, your turn. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Two things. Yeah. One, I live right by the forest preserve.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've seen the praying mantises out there. I saw one. It was a smaller one. I assume it was male. And it was red. It was living on some red-leaved bushes.
Well, it is amazing that the mantids and some of the grasshoppers and whatnot have some really bizarre color forms. I mean, I've seen pink katydids and whatnot, things that you'd think have to show up in the tropics. And so I don't think that's out of the realm of normal color patterns. They're not common, but I think that is in the range of the normal genetic variation that you see.
Well, then I almost ran over a nymph with my lawnmower one year, so I picked him up and threw him in the bushes by my picture window,
mm-hmm.
and he lived there all summer.
Yeah. They love bushes. I tell people, you know, to put them in the garden, it doesn't work very well because they eat each other and, you know, so they're somewhat territorial and they're not real fond of a lot of the garden pests, but their favorite environment would be in a hedge or something similar. And they will catch bees, they'll catch grasshoppers. They like big things to eat, not necessarily small things.
Well, he didn't like box elder bugs.
Yeah, well, that's, you know.
Because he wasn't eating any of them.
And I think that has to do with the red color and whatnot, that they have some chemical defenses.
I get them inside. I still, even now, I'll probably find one today.
Mm-hmm.
Where would they be breeding or living inside the house?
Again, no breeding. Everything, they work up underneath siding and the like, and then depending, they can kind of weasel through. And sometimes the pattern is such. If you see them in one room, at least you know the corner, although most of the time you're going to see the problems accumulate where the sun hits the house because they just love to be attracted to these sunny areas. That's what they use to warm their bodies. So the south side in particular, sometimes the east sides of the house, because the morning sun in particular is where they're migrating from. Now, to take a step back, sometimes in certain situations we find there's one box elder tree. It's not very pretty in the landscape. And if you eliminate the tree, there's no place for the box elder bugs to breed in the summer. And that is the solution to the problem. In your case, being next to the forest preserve, there's probably far too many wild
way
trees.
Too many.
So you can't do that part of it. So, and as I said, everything you see came in during September, and now some are just waking up.
And thanks a lot for calling, Brian. Appreciate it. Our guest today, Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at insects now on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest, and he comes by about once a month to talk with us about what's going on in the world of insects. Join us with your questions at 800-642-1234 or at email talk@wpr.org. And Phil, speaking of emails, we received one from Bernie in Muscadet, who says, can we safely move a garden spider egg sac at this time of year? It's located on a piece of machinery that needs to be used soon, and using this machinery will destroy the egg sac. If the egg sac can be moved, where would you put it now in this cold of January?
Well, I assume it's probably in a garage or an outbuilding of some sort, and so it's been acclimated to the cold weather. And so, yeah, I think you can move it relatively easily. I would just say put it in some kind of semi-sheltered site, you know, a corner of a building, you know, in the like, and it should be just fine. You wouldn't want to bring it indoors because then the additional heat will cause the little spiders to hatch way too early. So if you leave it in a relatively cool environment, a normal and natural environment, yeah, it shouldn't be any problem at all moving it.
Let's go to Dennis in West Allis now. Dennis, hello.
Hello, Larry. Hi, Phil. Love the show. Great topic.
Thank you.
My question was about centipedes. We just recently moved into a house late last winter, you know, early spring area, and we've had a problem with centipedes. And I would kill, you know, sometimes five a day just in the bathroom down in the basement there. And, you know, it's kind of a problem, and I'm not crazy about centipedes, you know, the fuzzy ones. They range anywhere from, you know, half inch to inch and a half. I was just wondering, is that a problem from the previous people that lived in the house? Or because it was vacant for a couple months before we moved in? And if I continue to kill them, will they just, you know, be done and go away? Or,
sure.
Or do I have to actually get, like, some kind of chemical for them?
Well, the thing about it is I'd really be interested to know if they're outdoor centipedes, which are just spilling in, which tell us the problem is more kind of a ceiling and structural thing, or are they, there is an indoor species that we call, I've seen it referred to as the Mexican house centipede, basically because it's normally found outdoors in Mexico, but not in our climate, but it does very well indoors. Those are the ones with the longest, creepiest legs. Those are the ones that really scoot like the Dickens. And those are the most common ones we see indoors. They are slow to breed, about a year and a half life cycle. Again, they have to have a lot to feed on. And so I'm wondering if just there was enough insects left behind that their populations built. one of the options I give people, because again, it's not like aphids that overnight you can have, you know, the populations explode, is rather than spraying for them, is these glue boards again, these sticky, you know, passive traps put back in corners. The less clutter there is, the less environments there will be for them. So in the basement, when things are open, but you put some of these little glue board traps back there and they will catch the centipedes. You don't have to worry about spraying them, and they will be probably more effective than you trying to hunt them down and catch them that way. So, and then let's just see. You can always take a picture of one or send a specimen to me just to verify it's not the outdoor type. The outdoor type, you know, usually we're looking at a crack in the foundation or, again, some kind of opening between the siding and in the foundation where they're squeezing up through. That should be more of a seasonal problem if that's what was going on.
Okay. I haven't had any really, you know, now that we're into the middle of the winter time here, I haven't seen any. I would say they probably ended October, November, probably.
Okay. Yeah, well, then it would be interesting. Now, every once in a while, I did have a person come in the laboratory. We had talked, you know, they were living over in the McFarland area, caught tremendous numbers of centipedes, so many so that I said, I have to see these. You know, it just isn't making sense. And, you know, again, in one of these glue traps at any one time in a week, they could catch 10 to 15, and this was consistent. It just wasn't. Yeah. And I really don't know. I'm still somewhat stumped at why they were so prolific when there was no other apparent food for them in the environment.
Interesting. Well, thanks, Dennis. Appreciate your call very much. Jave in Door County? Hi, thank you for calling.
Thanks. I have two comments, just comments, and then I'll get off the phone because I'm on the freeway. But one is, you were talking about mantis. My house in Judville has tons of praying mantises and walking sticks all around it. Judville's halfway between Egg Harbor and Fish Creek.
Uh-huh. Well, we definitely, I've known that the population has been up in the Door County area, too.
Oh.
And so that's interesting. And again, we've kind of always written that off, that your climate's just a little bit more tempered.
Uh-huh.
And that may be part of it. So, yeah, I know, in fact, I had heard that somebody from the DNR a few years back was looking into that whole thing about that breeding population. And that was the first one I was aware of in the state.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Thank you. Oh, we lost you.
Now, the walking stick thing is a little bit broader. I mean, we have a native species of walking stick that's often associated with oak woodlots. Although we did get one, I had a sample come in this past year from up in Devil's Lake of a great big walking stick. It's about 4 inches long with a red stripe on the back. I was ran up, and when I see things I haven't seen before, I run up to our museum, and sure enough, we had two specimens in the museum, one identified, one not. It is called the giant walking stick. It is native to the U.S., and the only specimens we've ever caught in the state have always been in Devil's Lake.
Ah.
Found nowhere else, and then the normal range is about central Iowa south. So they were found in Arkansas, Missouri, and the like. So that's just kind of a curious one, and as we know, Devil's Lake is a very unique place, and this is just one other example.
Thanks again, Jave. I'm sorry we lost you there. Your signal went kaput. Pat in Richland Center, we're on to you now. Hi, Pat.
Yes. Last summer, the honeybee developed a colony on an old barn of ours. And I understand the honeybee population's under stress. And would there be anything besides just leaving them alone to kind of ensure that they'd be...
Well, what it will be very interesting to see is if they survive the winter. You know, what we have seen in the last 20 years plus is about a third, the population is reduced by a third because of various issues. A lot of them are mite related and other parasites and diseases. And so what typically was happening is a lot of these, quote, wild bees, they may have escaped from some commercial beekeeper or some hobbyist, but these wild colonies were just not strong enough to be able to develop enough heat to survive the winter.
Oh.
So that will be the first question, is the swarm moved in, and was the colony strong enough? I will tell you that we are suspicious that the bees have been selected for, and they're doing better. Some of these colonies are naturally doing better against the mites without being medicated, so this is kind of a selection process. But it's probably best to leave them be for now. I guess I'd say if they're in an area that's a problem to you, one of the things is to ask around if there's a local beekeeper that may be willing to come this spring. In fact, there is a list. The Wisconsin Honey Producers has a list of beekeepers in various areas of the state that are willing to come to get bees. Many people are too busy to do it, but there are these people that have volunteered and said, you know, if you got bees next to the Milton area, call this number and whatnot. So that would be a place to check that if they do get to be a problem, as I said, you could have the person come in and see if they can basically capture a majority. They don't get them all, but capture a majority of the bees and bring them back in so they can keep them in one of their colonies.
All right. Thanks, Pat, for calling. Appreciate it. Jeff in La Crosse, on to you now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there. I'm sure you've answered this question a million times, but I've got such a god-awful problem with these Asian ladybugs this year. All winter long, it just doesn't seem like there's been any relief. I mean, usually in the wintertime, they die back, but they're just constant this year. And I don't know how or even or when or with what how to handle it, or maybe we can. I don't know. Looking for some advice.
Yeah, well, basically the option is knowing that you've got a problem. And with this larger number, and you know, I have people send me pictures that when they pull the siding from the way from the house, it is packed absolutely tight. Any void space is tight with lady beetles. So we're talking, and again, one of the days on the show we were talking where a guy was re-siding, and he said he could fill a 5-gallon bucket between every stud in his wall voids. But it all comes back to that last couple days of September and the early part of October. The trigger to start them coming in is a frost. And then a nice Indian summer day, you know, those beautiful warm days. And that's when they come in, and it's the south side of the house in particular. And so there are sprays that can be applied, and that's what we talk about, is putting them on before this gets started, because we know when the window will be. You can't wait till November and let them get under the siding, because then the sprays won't work. So if you can't find the way to physically keep them out, you spray the outside. And these are basically the same sprays we're using in the garden or in the dairy barn to get rid of flies. Yeah, things like permethrin in cyfluthrin. So they used to be things 10 years ago, they weren't easy to get, but now almost everything you find on the shelf at the hardware stores or the big box stores will be this kind of product. The problem is spraying enough of the side of the house. We're not talking just, you know, with a can of Raid. You need to get maybe a gallon or 2 gallons of dilute product on and spray all around the soffits, all around the window frames, everything but the windows, basically what I tell people. The sprays repel them, first of all, so they don't want to land. And if they do land, it will kill them before they can get in. And so that's the secret. And you can have this commercially done, but you can do it yourself as long as, again, depending on the size of the house. And
like with a garden sprayer or something like that?
Yeah, definitely. In this case, I think I like something like a little compressed air sprayer better than the hose end attachments. What I'm worried about there is you throw such large volume and you're washing half of off what you put on there. So it wouldn't be so good for that. But, yeah, definitely if you got a small, you know, 1-gallon sprayer, that's more than sufficient to do things. And just kind of said, get up there, get in all those little cracks and crevices. But if you're going to start on the south side of the house. North sides very often have no problems. These things are very visual. What attracts them is the contrast of light and dark that you see on these sunny days. And they come in like a magnet to it.
It's awful.
There.
All right, well, that's good news. I listen to this all the time, and I know you've talked about it. I just haven't heard the answer to it. So.
Sure.
Well, there you have it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. And Judy emailed and says, my husband brought home a very large paper wasp nest, maybe 18 inches long, wants to bring it in the house near his mounted bear. And I'm afraid the wasp may be in there hibernating. How do we know if it's empty?
Well, the only bee that hibernates as a colony is the honeybee. So I can tell you that it's dormant. There's nothing there. There are no bees or wasps that are going to come out. And so usually I tell people outdoors you can collect them about the 1st of November, and there's nothing to worry about after that time. So, yeah, you were way too late, and it would be fine to bring it in. And, you know, as long as you keep water away from it, it will stay that way forever.
And Carol and Dave had a similar question from Wisconsin Rapids. They have a large wasp nest under their deck and wondering if they can just remove it, and what should they do with it at that point?
Well, you don't have to remove it. The one thing is that they do not reuse the nests, which we think is an evolutionary a device so that you don't get exposed to diseases and whatnot. So it makes some sense not to, you know, to go back to your old home, if you want to think of it that way. So if it's too hard to get to, just leave it. If you can get to it, you can just cut it down and just throw it, and it will degrade relatively quickly because it is basically like paper. That's what they use chewed up cellulose and construct that the casing that they have on there, and there's really not much to it. The other thing you find sometimes when you're walking in the woods in the fall is that both skunks and raccoons will go in and tear these up because at that time of the year they're going after the grubs that are in there.
Oh, so. Well, if you leave them up, then will that prevent another group from coming in?
No correlation. They don't observe it and whatnot. So, yeah, it doesn't matter if you take them down or not. It's not going to influence where the queens are going to start new nests the next year.
Tracy in Laval, it is your turn. Hi, Tracy.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
The parasitic wasps that you can buy for fly control, I wanted to know if it's worth buying them or is it something that doesn't do a very good job?
If you're after house flies and the like and you follow the directions of releasing them on a regular basis, they are very effective.
But these are parasitic wasps that you put out in the pasture to keep down the face flies and whatever that are on cattle.
Yes.
That's what they sell them for.
Right.
I just wondering if those were worth the price.
They will help. But again, you have to keep on introducing them. You know, where they probably had more success because it's been a bigger issue is dealing with house flies around barns and the like, which is a different fly. And that's what you got to make sure is that you're matching the parasite against, you know, in your case, horn flies and face flies would be the pasture problem. And the problem then is to get them out there, too. You do have to physically take them. They're not that efficient flying. And, you know, in some cases, when you release beneficial insects, they establish on their own and take off. Here, what you're really doing is enhancing what's out there naturally. And so that's why you have to keep on reintroducing them. But, again, as long as you're sure that the people that are selling it to you are selling you ones, the varieties that are made for going after horn flies and face flies, then you will get a positive effect out of it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Tracy. Al in Milwaukee, on to you now. Hi, Al.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got a question for Phil in terms of his advice. I'm a wood turner, and I've collected a variety of species of wood and cut them up into bowl blanks and spindle blanks, and I found that some of the pieces were infected with what I think is powder post beetles.
Okay.
And I consulted with Forest Products Lab, and I got a suggestion of freeze and thaw kind of thing. I isolated the infected wood, put them in a small garbage can, sealed it up with duct tape, and then when the frigid weather started, I put it outside for 5 days. I bring it in for 5 days. I take it out for 5 days. And the idea is that the initial freeze would kill off the live worms or beetles or whatever they are, and then the thaw would activate the eggs, and then another freeze would kill them off. Am I tracking in the right direction with this? Or
yes, I'm not so sure you're killing eggs. And there aren't that many eggs present at any one time, and the eggs hatch relatively quickly. And the normal time that most of the eggs are getting laid probably is in June. But what you're doing here, it's all about shock. And, you know, we tell people, because you see this in firewood. If firewood is infested with powder post beetles and it's stored in the garage, it will survive the winter even if it's 20 below. But by taking things at relatively room temperature, so in other words, the insects are active and doing their thing, and then exposing them to this drastic cold change is a major shock, kills a lot of them. You bring them back, warm them up, so any that survive start to get going again, and then you slam the door a second time. So that's the science behind it. As I said, the only mistake you could make with using the freeze-thaw method is if they were already exposed to cold weather and dormant before you started, then I wouldn't think it's been cold enough to do you any good.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it.
Now, the other option, you know, in cases, is to heat them out. You know, insects are killed at about 110 to 115 degrees, so kilns would be an option. And then the third possibility, which is not as a direct kill them now, but in wood situations, they use these borate powders that you mix with water, put in the wood, and that's a stomach poison. And so what it does is that it soaks in, not very deep, into the wood, but when the beetles are coming up to the surface and feeding on the wood, they also ingest the boric acid, basically, that's in there. Sodium octaborate is the official chemical, and they die that way. So there are two or three options, but for a quick way, if they're small items, this freeze-thaw is a great way to do it.
On to Dick and Racine now. Dick, hello to you. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I was chainsawing some buckthorn in a local park, and after I dropped a tree, insects came streaming out of the ground or out of the crown of the tree. I ran about a block to my car. They kept pelting me and following me, and literally three or four got in the car. I got stung 4 or 5 times. I'm kind of wondering what they might be, and will they freeze out so I can go back in and cut more buckthorn?
What time of the year was this?
This was in the fall.
Okay. It was one of the paper wasps. And, you know, we were talking before about the beneficial side of paper wasps, and they, you know, are eating all these caterpillars and the like. But the bottom thing with anything that lives in a nest, if you bother the nest, they are incredibly aggressive.
Okay.
But as we had talked about the people that were bringing the nests in, by the 1st of November, you could start cutting the buckthorn again without any problem. I don't care if there's a nest up there or not. They're not going to be active. The other thing is temperature related is, you know, insects in general, you start getting around 40 degrees or less. I don't care how riled up they get. They just can't generate enough body heat to function.
Okay.
So the cold would do it. But we're, again, late enough in the season, nothing to worry about. And you won't see the colonies build to a point that they're going to be aggressive again well until July of next year. So you got a big time frame to work with.
Oh, good. I've been cutting in the winter. I don't have any problem with them now.
No.
Right.
No.
And you can go well into the spring because, again, the colonies are so small, it's not a problem. It's getting late July, August, and then in September, and as long as the weather allows. I mean, as I said, I usually use the cutoff of the 1st of November before it's really safe. Some falls are cold enough that they really don't freeze out. They starve to death.
Oh.
You know, it gets so cold they can't go out and fly to get food, and if you can't get food, they don't have any food reserves like honeybees, and so they just can't tolerate that extended period of time with no food.
All right. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it, Dick. Eric in Madison, your turn. Hi, Eric.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I've got a question about some beetles, perhaps beetles. I've got some property up near Spartiform McCoy with oak trees on it, and we've had it tested for oak wilt, and we didn't get anything, but that doesn't mean it's not there. They did find some other kind of fungus up there, but then the gentleman at the extension suggested it might be the emerald chestnut borer.
Yeah, well, the two-line chestnut borer is the problem on oak, and we have seen a lot of problems related to the summer droughts. That when the trees are stressed, they get weakened, and this borer will come in and attack them. The good news I will tell you, I was very concerned because I was seeing a lot of dying oaks coming in the lab the last few years, but the rainfall patterns of the last year or so have really turned it around, that the trees will be able to defend themselves as long as they get enough moisture to grow. You know, if this was a tree in your front yard, there are some chemical solutions you could think of because it's a high-value tree. But if you're talking about a woodlot property, the best news for this is exactly what has happened is we're starting to get sufficient moisture levels that the trees will be able to actively fight off the infestation, whereas if it's droughty, they're so weakened they can't fight off the infestation. That's when the chestnut borer kills them.
All right. We have Pat from Manitowoc says they came across 4 to 5 dead wasps in their various places in their basement floor. They need to be concerned about live wasps or anything to do there.
No, there won't be any nest anymore. What you do see once in a while is overwintering queens, especially if you got a lot of, you know, nooks and crannies. But they leave in the spring, you know, so there's not a nest per se. There isn't anything to worry about.
And Tom says Japanese beetles are killing his American linden. He's using milky spore. What else can he do?
Well, the problem with milky spore, there's two concerns. The beetles can fly from a half a mile away, so people have to get out of the mindset that the problem is in their yard. It's coming from down the way. Lindens tolerate the defoliation. They look terrible. They look very thin, but the next spring they usually leaf out just fine. If you want to keep the leaves on, there is a systemic insecticide you can apply. Bayer sells it as their tree and shrub insecticide. Fertilome sells it as their systemic shrub and tree drench. And you mix it up with water, you pour it on, and the roots suck it up. The problem is the bigger the tree, the harder it is to get in and the more expensive it is to treat. But to be honest, we've had very good success. Or you can call an arborist to have this put on. The reason you're having it put on, though, is to keep the tree full and green. Life and death, as I said, I don't see Japanese beetle kill it.
And with that, we have to conclude for another day. Phil, you'll be back in, what, a month or so? We'll do this
again. Sounds good.
Thank you very much. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest, works out of that insect diagnostic lab. I'm really always happy to have him with us, and he will be back in about a month or so, and we'll do this all over again. Sorry we didn't get to everyone. Just to let you know, tomorrow we'll talk about, at 11, digital cameras. Jack Socha of Spring Grove, Minnesota, talking about how to use those cameras you got for Christmas or for the holidays. And then at 11:45, Apple Computers and Accessories with Joe Rhodes. Stay with us.